his demeanor shifted to become more defensive. The guard's actions were entirely reasonable, considering. "I don't know about that," I said. "I was standing passively inside the hedgerow. There was no way out. I wasn't running away." "He found you lying on top of her. She was naked. You were practically so. You were covered with her blood and fingernail scratches. And furthermore, you had a crazed look on your face." "The guard must have been looking in the mirror. He's the one who had a crazed look." "You've thought about this pretty carefully, haven't you?" "As a matter of fact, I haven't." He said, "I'm not going to argue with you. If you intend on suing the university, go ahead. You won't win, and you will still be expelled." I remarked, "Who said anything about suing?" He paused and looked at me calculatingly. He then rolled his chair back a few inches, enough to allow him access to his middle desk drawer. And keeping his left hand in his lap, with his right hand he removed a sheet of paper from the drawer and tossed it across the desk to me. "Then sign that and be done with it." I may not have been thinking about it carefully, but obviously someone had. "Sign that, and I will overlook your probation violations. You can return to your classes. You might even graduate." I was tempted to jokingly bring up the matter of my rescinded scholarship, but decided not to. Dean Simmons was the kind of authority figure with whom it was never a good idea to attempt a bargain or try to place oneself on equal footing. I had leverage now, but that would vanish the instant I signed. Not having any intention of suing the university anyway, I did so. He took back the document and returned it to his desk drawer, locking it inside. "You know, Mr. Robinson, I have a hard time understanding college bums like you. Every class has its few. You take your education so frivolously. To you, it's just a silly game, isn't it? A four-year idle ride, and when you get bored, you sneak off to Hawaii and go surfing." He paused for a reply. Unless required, I wasn't about to give one. "I thought so. Very well. But just so we understand each other, any more violations or any more shenanigans of any kind that further embarrasses this institution, and you can expect that you will be expelled, and that this time it will be permanent. Not even your mentor, Professor Hopkins, will be able to save you next time." So as not to completely roll over and play submissive, I said, "Would you agree, Dean Simmons, that the person who actually hurt the school's reputation is the person who committed the murder?" "No, I would not agree with that, not entirely."
"You wouldn't?"
"No, I would not. Let me explain something to you that you obviously fail to grasp. Our reputation is the school's most valuable asset. Based on the strength and solidity of that reputation, important decisions get made by many important people from many sectors of life that greatly affect this college and this university." He brought his hands up as if he was going to enumerate them for me, and in doing so, for the first time, brought his left hand into view. I was startled to see it was bandaged. Strips of gauze were wound across his palm and the back of his hand. Taking a guess, it looked like the primary site of the injury was concentrated along the fleshy heel of the hand, or that part that palm readers refer to as the Mound of Luna. The dean was still blathering. "Wealthy alumni who each year donate large sums, who remember us in their wills, not to mention the directors and trustees of philanthropic foundations. Our reputation commands respect from many other academic institutions, from government agencies, from corporations, from think tanks, and from every sector of the civilized world. And it is on the strength of this reputation that determinations are made of who gets the bequests and who gets the research money and the best faculty and so forth and so on and so on." I was going to say, "Hear, hear," if he said one more, and so on, but he didn't, so I kept my mouth shut. I assumed he was done and began heading out, but he stopped me again. "There is one more thing," he said. "There is the other important category I haven't mentioned, students, the best and the brightest. We compete for them. And each year, tens of thousands of high school juniors have to make the first big decision of their lives, maybe the most important decision they will ever make, and one that has to have mom and dad's approval as well, and that is to decide which schools they are going to apply to. Now, what effect do you suppose it has on any of those decision makers when they happen to turn on their breakfast televisions and see a half-naked Columbia student marched in handcuffs up the police house steps, scratched and bleeding and grinning, for God's sake? It wasn't a grin, sir. It was a wince, I assure you. I was in pain and the lights were making me squint. No, no, it doesn't work that way. You see, you looked like you were grinning. And that, I'm telling you, is the image that is going to stick in people's minds and be remembered by everyone who saw it. Just as during the 60s, the photo of the student radicals who had taken over the president's office and were sitting in his chair and smoking his cigars, that was the image of Columbia that everyone remembered for years and years afterwards. So when I say it was you who hurt the school's reputation, I mean it was you. It doesn't matter at all that I'm not guilty, that I am completely innocent in all this, I said. It matters to the police. It matters less to me, just as I explained. Although I would still like to know why you are no longer considered a suspect. Are you sure Detective Lippincott didn't tell you? You know the police, they're pretty tight-lipped. Well, meeting over, leave my presence. This was as close to a vaya con Dios as I was going to get. His dismissal was accompanied by a flip of his bandaged hand, which he did without thinking and which resulted in a fleeting stab of pain, a wince of his own, registering on his face. Obviously, I had misread the creases in his forehead for worry lines when they were actually caused by a freshly throbbing injury. As I let myself out, I stopped by the secretary's desk to politely inquire how the dean had hurt his hand. She said non-responsively, "Yes, he did." "How?" I asked again. She gave me a withering look and in a crisp one-sentence reply said, "He was bitten by a dog." "Oh, no kidding, a dog?" "Yes." "What kind of dog?" "I wasn't there." "Last night?" She didn't reply, so I added, "It's a good thing it wasn't a lion." "Why is that?" she said. "Because you know what they say. He who has his hand in the lion's mouth must pull it out as best he can." "Who's they?" "It's an old Greek proverb, or maybe a Scottish one. I'm not sure." Still fishing for more information, I ventured, "Dog bites are serious. I hope he's had it looked after." "He's seen a doctor, thank you." She wasn't thanking me. I offered a generous smile, and she returned a frozen facsimile. She leaned forward in her chair, folded her arms, and positioned her elbows on the little padded corners of her desk blotter. It was a clear signal that we were at the end of the line, conversation-wise. I wished her a good day. Walking away, I repeated to myself the proverb, "He who has his hand in the lion's mouth must pull it out as best he can." The same might be said of the mouth of a dog, or possibly even the mouth of a murdered co-ed.